Now, 38 states at the last count and the District of Columbia have issued stay-at-home orders of one sort or another in the effort to fight the coronavirus outbreak. Still, about a dozen states have not. Public health experts say the orders are crucial to reducing the number of patients who will need hospitalization from the virus. So far, the Trump administration has declined to urge all states to issue those orders. And some are pointing to the U.S. system of federalism that divides power between states and the federal government, saying it's not really effective during a global pandemic. Polly Price is a professor of law and global health at Emory University. She was a 2017 Carnegie Fellow, and her forthcoming book is called Plagues in the Nation, looking at the challenges that epidemics and disease control pose to democratic societies. Polly, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Start us off, please, with the Civics 101. When we're talking about federalism in the United States, what do we mean about the division of powers here?
What we mean is that states control certain aspects of daily life for Americans, and the federal government is involved and controls other aspects of it. So it ranges from, it's been a basic precept of government in the United States since the founding period is this division of authority that we call federalism. Is what is it that is within a state's authority to control versus what the federal government can intervene in?
And that's a big question during this time of a pandemic. I want to give a listen to Surgeon General Jerome Powell talking to NBC's Savannah Guthrie, answering a question about whether every state should have a stay-at-home order.
We live in a nation that has a system of federalism, and the governors get to make the decisions, but we're going to give them the best possible guidance we can, that's to stay at home and to social distance.
So what has struck you so far about the division of responsibility taking shape between the federal government and then state governments right now?
I think right now it's exactly this point that 38 states have done enacted measures for social distancing that will be uniform within their states versus those that have not. And to give you just one example of the problems it can cause when there's not at least a statewide policy. So in Metro Atlanta, before the governor, who has since issued a statewide policy for stay-at-home, shelter-in-place, before that happened, local governments were stepping up and imposing their own orders in the absence of statewide guidance. They were following federal guidance, but they had to act on their own. These are very unpopular decisions. So when a local government has to step forward to do that, the governor can actually end up taking the heat off of that by giving a statewide policy. So before Georgia went to a statewide policy, in Metro Atlanta, there are actually four or five different health jurisdictions, municipalities, county governments. They came together, not at all at the same time, but they came together to issue stay-at-home advisories, a curfew in some instance. But the problem for the Metro Atlanta area was they were sort of imposed at different times. People became confused about what was in effect where. And from where I live, I had a DeKalb County shelter-in-place order that came out one afternoon, the same time that I saw an announcement from City of Atlanta, which I also live in the City of Atlanta, saying that they would not have a shelter-in-place order announced that evening, but the next day they did. So I was in a situation where I walk 100 yards down the street and I'm no longer in a shelter-in-place order. And that kind of local decision-making doesn't work in densely populated areas. So that's just one example. I think a national policy, I understand why a national policy, the Surgeon General and others are urging nationwide for stay-at-home orders. And we shouldn't discount the importance of their voice. I do think it's advisory, but it's even more important for the governors to step forward and help provide some uniformity for at least those living within their states.
if I'm a president, can I say, hey, we're doing stay at home nationwide? Is that something I even have the power to do?
I think certainly you can advise it and urge it, but it is not something that in our constitutional structure we have any experience with. We don't have those traditionally have been under state and local control, those kinds of social distancing measures. Any kind of public health emergency measures have traditionally been there. So I don't think under our constitutional structure there's actual authority. Now, Congress could pass a statute that would enable that sort of authority. But again, it's we have always relied on state and local health departments. And now that we have all 50 state governors have declared states of emergency of one form or another, that gives them extended powers. So I think most clearly under our system of government that the authority is in the states. And if there is a way that the states could come together with some sort of uniform policy, that is, I think, the closest we can get to having a nationwide approach on stay-at-home orders.
Talking to Polly Price from Emory University about federalism. You got state governments, you got the federal government, and how it works in a time of pandemic. Polly, the big flashpoint right now seems to be equipment. The ventilators people are talking about, the personal protective equipment. The White House has seemed to indicate states you're mostly on your own for getting stuff, and so they're bidding with each other. Then to find out that the federal government is beating them to the punch and buying the stuff, the president's son-in-law arguing with governors about whether they need ventilators, as many as they say, in their state. This seems like the system is not functioning smoothly. Am I right?
I think you are absolutely right. It's not functioning smoothly. It is not a it's not a good thing. This is another aspect of our system of government that makes it more difficult for the United States to respond in the same ways that other countries have. And that is that we not only do we have our public health defense scattered among more than 2,000 state and local health departments, we also don't have a national health system. We have a collection of private health providers, a few state-funded hospitals, the VA, very fragmented. And so that's where we see hospitals bidding against each other to get their supplies with their state governors trying to help them. In theory, we have a national stockpile that is under federal control as to how to distribute it, but it's clearly inadequate. We don't have the stockpile that we need at this point. So yes, it is a problem. It's a work in progress, and it's something that we'll just continue to deal with, I think, in the coming weeks.
Is the idea here that the federal government or someone within the federal government is supposed to be the, I've heard the quarterback analogy used, the person who is maybe not telling all the states what to do, but coordinating efforts, avoiding these kind of conflicts over materials like this?
Well, I think the federal government is the only authority that can do that kind of coordination. Now, it's true that all of our emergency laws at the federal level, the Stafford Act, for example, which is in response to natural disasters, hurricanes, earthquakes, and that sort of thing, they're all designed for the federal government to help states, but they're not designed for anything on a nationwide basis. In other words, FEMA would gear up after Hurricane Katrina or for Matthew. And they are able to help coordinate among two or three states, but we don't have any experience with a nationwide emergency. And our laws really just aren't set up to facilitate this smoothly.
We're talking to Polly Price, an expert on federalism and global health from Emory University. We're talking about how the American system of federalism, the division of labor between the federal and state government, is affecting the country's response to the novel coronavirus. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the federal government should be playing a bigger role in this outbreak? What do you think of their coordination of the response so far? What do you look at when you look at governors taking the lead on these issues here in Wisconsin or around the country? Do you feel like there's a unified message, a unified effort going on here? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Polly Price from Emory University. We're talking about the American system of federalism and how it's shaping the U.S. response to the coronavirus. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you listening from a place that doesn't have a stay-at-home order somewhere in the country? If so, how have you been figuring out what feels safe to do and what doesn't? And what do you think about what you're hearing from the federal government, from your state government, whether it's Wisconsin or elsewhere? And do you think everybody's playing well together? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Polly, you recently wrote a piece looking back about 100 years to the big flu, the big influenza outbreak that killed a lot of people. Were there lessons there for, I know the American government was very different then, but were there lessons from that time that we could have learned and applied today?
I think we have learned from them and are applying them today. There was a study in 2007 that looked back at some of the social distancing measures that were taken during the pandemic flu of 1918 and 1919. And it concluded that those cities and areas that used sustained measures of social distancing did better in terms of mortality than cities that did not. And so I think we've known for some time that these measures work, but they have to be sustained. They have to be put in place at the right time. It's interesting to compare also the epidemics of yellow fever that the South experienced in the late 19th century. And in those situations, we saw other states and localities actually shutting out travelers from people who were trying to escape areas that were experiencing a yellow fever outbreak. So, for example, in Louisiana, people had difficulty leaving New Orleans because places, points further north, would bar them from coming in. State governments would do that. Local governments would do that, stop the rail lines and not permit travel. It was the early precursor to the U.S. Public Health Service ended up in the late 19th century setting up some refugee camps for these people who were trying to leave Pensacola, Mobile, other places during some of these terrible outbreaks. And just to give them a place to stay, to live. It's really the first use of the term refugee I've ever seen applied to U.S. citizens. But in any event, it was recognized in other parts of the nation that this is a real problem if local governments can prevent travel in that way. And so Congress at that time debated over the course of several years what to do about what they called the shotgun quarantine, preventing people from leaving and entering new areas. And they ended up passing the authority that the CDC and HHS has today to prevent the spread of disease from one state into another using what we call interstate quarantine authority. But it too is not really designed to be used on a large scale. And all of the precedent that we have in terms of what are the constitutional limits on what a state or local government can do and when the federal government can step in are from more than a century ago.
Let's bring on a caller before we run out of time. Brian is with us in Fort Atkinson. Brian, hi.
Hi. Yeah, it surprises me that we don't have a plan in place.
Okay, Brian, thanks for the call. Polly, I mean, do we have a plan? Don't we run drills and exercises to make sure we can coordinate this kind of thing?
Oh, yes. And state and local public health departments have routinely run drills, and I sat in on some myself, where they try to plan out how they would respond to an epidemic, and they do a very, very good job of recognizing the need to coordinate with other health departments. The decisions, the actual decisions, though, about what measures to take are made by elected officials. You know, so at the end of the day, it's going to be the governor that makes the order or the mayor that makes the order. And so we hope that they are doing so based on the best advice they have from public health officials. So that, but let me also just mention one other thing. We have had, in effect, for a number of years, Congress enacted the Pandemic Preparedness Act, which, among other things, requires hospitals to plan for emergencies and how they would staff pandemics and so forth. So it's not that we've done nothing. We've done a lot. And it's the but and the Pandemic Health Preparedness Act also had some funds that they made available for both health departments and hospitals to practice for these kinds of emergencies. The difference is, I don't think it was, it was difficult probably for any of these local groups who are practicing to imagine that they would be doing so in the context of shortages of critical equipment.
We'll leave it there for now. Polly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Polly Price, an expert on law and global health from Emory University, author of the forthcoming book, Plagues in the Nation. She was with us today to talk about the balance of power in the U.S. between states and the federal government and how that impacts the government's response to the novel coronavirus.